Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for another conversation. Today we have Jeffrey Vaughn, who is professor of political science at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's the editor of a new book entitled Leo Strauss and His Catholic Readers, published by Catholic University Press. Welcome, Professor Vaughn.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so we have a topic here, Leo Strauss and his Catholic readers. Not a common, not the first thing you think of when you hear Leo Strauss's name. So maybe we'll start by having you just tell our listeners a little bit of background about who Leo Strauss was.
Leo Strauss was born in Prussia, Germany, in 1899, and grew up, as far as we can tell, with various stories, in an Orthodox or at least conservative, certainly in a practicing Jewish household. Went to school and university in Marburg, where he ran into almost all of the great names of early 20th century German philosophy. Walter Benjamin, through teachers, his teachers Husserl, Martin Heidegger.
He took classes with Husserl.
Husserl and Heidegger,
and
both.
And Heidegger,
yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so a lot, very connected to really the great authors of the time. And Hannah Arendt as well, knew Hannah Arendt. He left Germany in about 1932. He won a Rockefeller Foundation grant, which took him to Paris, and then from there went to Cambridge University in England, couldn't find a position, and eventually moved to New York City.
To what extent was the rise of fascism in Germany and the anti-Semitism factor part of his flight?
Almost 100% of what was happening. Again, from what we understand, Martin Heidegger suggested he get out of the country.
Really?
Yes. And he continued a correspondence with Heidegger after he left, until Heidegger stopped returning his letters, for obvious reasons. Right? We know Heidegger's history there. So, escaping Germany was a big part, almost the sole reason why he left. So he makes his way to the United States, works briefly at Columbia, and then has a position at the New School for Social Research, where he stayed for several years, and then eventually moves to the University of Chicago. And that's the institution most people think of when they think of Leo Strauss.
Is that where Alan Bloom was his student?
And Alan Bloom was his student there.
All the Straussians.
Yes. Yeah. When one thinks of Straussians, and I hope we get back to that term at some point later.
Yes, yes.
But when one thinks of Straussians, Straussianism, the Strauss's project, one thinks of the University of Chicago. That's where he had his seminars. My father studied with him there. And my father tells these stories of chain-smoking Leo Strauss mumbling at the front of the room with people packed into this small seminar space, sitting on the floor, sitting on top of desks. There's absolutely no space to move, and hanging on every word. So there was that's what people think of. He left the University of Chicago in 1969 upon his retirement, and died in 1973. He went to St. John's College in Annapolis and died there.
He taught there for a time?
And did teach there.
Yes. Wow. You know, what you said about people packing the room, what was it about Strauss that cultivated so many disciples, that gave us the term Straussians? Mm-hmm. You know, someone can be a Straussian. Was it his charisma? Or was it something about the nature of his ideas? Because you see this in academia, how there are some brilliant thinkers out there who end up being surrounded by followers. They make them into disciples. And there are other kinds of thinkers who you can say they're just as smart. Their ideas may be just as influential, but they don't produce the cult
that
surrounds them. What was it about Strauss that seemed to do this?
Well, if you listen to his students or listen to the audible recordings, audio recordings.
I heard an audible recording of him a while back. He spoke very slowly and very, very thoughtfully, but you did kind of start getting mesmerized by what he was saying. I will say that.
Yep. Charismatic might not be the right word, but there's something about what he was saying. So, again, my father was a student of his, and my father's account is that here was a man who, well, much as Leo Strauss said of Heidegger, you felt you were in the presence of philosophy. The same thing would be said about Strauss. You really felt that here was somebody who was taking Plato, Aristotle, Machiavelli, any of these authors as serious thinkers, timeless thinkers, who could give us answers that apply today. And remember, this is in the 50s, 60s. So much of the academic approach to the history of philosophy was as an historical curiosity. If you look at the works of Sabine and others in the period, you would read Plato and chuckle at all of his absurdities because we know so much more than he did. Mm-hmm. You look at Aristotle and, oh goodness,
right,
a rock has an appetite to fall.
Right.
How silly.
Right.
How quaint. Let's move on because we know so much more. And Strauss turned.
I think when I was at UCLA, if you went over to the philosophy department, and you asked to take a course on Hegel, that was anything but just history, old history kinds of things, they would say that belongs really in the religion department.
Right.
Okay. We do philosophy. We analyze language. We moved on from all those metaphysical nonsensical questions.
Right.
And they meant that literally. And what you said about Strauss feeling like here you're in the presence of philosophizing taking place. Hannah Arendt said something like that about Heidegger.
Yes.
So we felt that in the room with Heidegger, we believe that somewhere in Germany, thought. I think that's how she put it. Mm-hmm. Thought. Was taking place. And I was speaking once to some older professors who were graduate students in the 60s who would jump in their car from Yale and they would go out to Cornell to sit in on the seminars given by Paul DeMond, the literary critic and scholar. And I said to him, why did you do that? I said, because we felt something was going on in that room, that De Man was working on something. It really was that sort of thinking, that Heideggerian idea that elsewhere we've slipped into mechanical or instrumentalized forms of mental activity. Here, where something genuine, something authentic. Is taking place.
And they're largely word games that were being played elsewhere.
Yeah.
And
there are stakes, real stakes here.
Yeah. And this is one of the things Strauss is known for, that philosophy isn't merely a system of argumentation, it's a way of life. That was his idea of recovering Platonic political philosophy. It's that philosophy is a way of life. It's not merely something that you do in your office and then you can leave. If this is true, it will change your life, and it must do so.
What? I mean, that starts sounding high. It does start sounding highly religious. What was Strauss? Was Strauss an atheist? Or maybe hard to say.
It is hard to say. There are actually conflicting accounts of his last words on his deathbed to two different students. It remains enigmatic.
He was always culturally Jewish.
Yes.
All right. So what did he think of religion broadly and society?
To ask about religion broadly sort of misses the point of what he was trying to get at. So he has been accused of, in some ways, thinking of religion as Gibbons describes the ancient Romans, that for the masses, they were all equally true, for the philosophers, equally useless, and for the statesmen, or for the philosophers, equally untrue, and for the statesmen, equally useful, right?
Okay.
That religion is something useful to pacify the masses. This isn't what he thought. For Strauss, the fundamental question is philosophy or religion. That is the fundamental question for each and every human being, because those are really the only answers. Those are the only source of answers. Either it's entirely reason, or it's entirely faith and revelation. Now, when you start to look at this, and several of the pieces in the book try to pull this apart, especially the first essay by Robert Cranach, Strauss's main idea of religion, he takes, I think, from his from the Jewish tradition, that religion is the command of God. Religion is law. And it is not something that needs to be understood. It simply needs to be accepted. Strauss was very influenced by the medieval Jewish philosophers, Maimonides especially. One of the reasons for the book is that his take on Christians is a little vague. Right? This is what we tried to pull out in this book. But for him, religion was law. And you obey the law, the 613 laws of the Jewish tradition. You obey those laws, and that's it. That's all you need to do, and that is rightful living. Philosophy, as he understood it, was a way of life that was different from religion. But so this is two competing ways of life, as he understood it. So talk about Christianity shows up as a problem for him because it's sort of both at once. The Christians almost immediately turn to philosophy to explain the faith. Even in the prologue to the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, right? It immediately sounds philosophical, and it is taken as one as the most philosophical of the Gospels. The Church Fathers immediately start turning to philosophy to explain the Trinity, to explain the doctrines of the Church. And so for Strauss, Christianity is this weird hybrid of philosophy and revelation. And he seems to have been very uneasy with that synthesis. It's that synthesis that is sort of sustained Catholicism in particular, right? With the Reformation, that synthesis largely breaks down. And that's what interested him, the synthesis, or not, it didn't so much interest him as he found it deeply problematic.
And this is part of the motivation for this book.
Yes.
Strauss and his Catholic readers. So why Catholic readers? They're more important. I mean, is that Strauss poses a particular challenge or interest for Catholic readers?
Well, I'd say there are two reasons for this. One, in conversation with friends, colleagues, is a strange sociological observation that there are an awful lot of Catholics who read Strauss. And there are a lot of people influenced by Strauss who teach at Catholic universities. I'm not sure if, I haven't run any statistics on this, but it's a strangely common feature that you have Strauss's students or their students or others who are at Catholic universities or are themselves Catholic. Harvey Mansfield at Harvard University has quipped that he should get a commission from the Catholic Church because so many of his students become Catholic. It's actually true. There are a great number of conversions that come out of studying with Harvey Mansfield, which is peculiar, I think, to say the least. So there's that sort of sociological fact. The other, more philosophical one, is expressed in a blurb we have from Pierre Manent, who's no stranger to the pages of First Things, who says that Strauss presents the most radical critique of the Catholic synthesis of faith and reason. And radical in that he takes both as being serious possibilities, not simply you can dismiss faith, we don't have to take, that's not a radical critique. Dismissal is not a radical critique, but an actual engagement with the possibility of revelation, which Strauss clearly says cannot be disproven by reason. You cannot disprove the possibility of revelation.
You say in your entry in the book that Strauss himself once said that Catholic social thought was the only holdout against modernity. What did he mean by that?
So when he was writing in the 50s, 60s, the Catholic Church and the position of most Catholic scholars resisted the historicist temptations of modern thought. That is, anything that comes later in time is better, anything that's further back is bad. He has a lovely statement in the essay Progress or Return? He has a lovely statement there where he says that the traditional distinction between good and evil has been replaced with the distinction between progress or reaction. Mm-hmm. And as far as he saw it, the Catholic social thought maintained a distinction between good and evil, and not simply progress and reaction. And that's where the Catholics maintained, as far as he was concerned, an older, fuller understanding of morality.
You also bring up in your entry the important feature in a discussion of natural law, and Strauss is important to discussions of natural law, that the element of folly is crucial. And I couldn't tell, were you bringing out the folly that one finds in the Gospels or in Paul, that we appear foolish, we appear figures of folly to the rest of the world, and I mean we sort of lost some of that acceptance of our own folly in the eyes of the world, which I think is in fact a mistake. I think we should accept our foolishness in the eyes of secularists. But is that what you were?
No,
I mean you were much more talking about natural law.
And yeah, I was talking in terms of natural law, but this question of folly, even the question of comedy, was an interesting one to Strauss. He was very taken with Aristophanes' play on Socrates, The Clouds. He points out that in the accounts that we have of Socrates, we never hear of him crying, only laughing, and yet the opposite is true of Christ. There's no account in the Gospels of Christ laughing, but we know that Jesus wept. So there's already a tension between the comic and the tragic, between in the philosophic and the religious, certainly the Christian. What I was pointing to in my essay is Strauss's interest in, you can find it in the Christian tradition, but his interest in how to implement the idea of or a particular system of organization, a regime, political regime, given that a lot of us are foolish, we don't understand, we make mistakes, so much if you think of certainly natural law as it's developed in the last 100 years, Brooks very little room for accommodating foolishness. In my essay, I mention the effort on the part of John Finnis, Germaine Grisey, Joseph Boyle, in their book on nuclear deterrence, in which they call for, and this is in the early 80s, unilateral disarmament in the Western nations. Simply because it says, the reasoning goes, these weapons are targeted at innocent civilians, that's wrong, therefore we shouldn't do it, therefore we should get rid of the armaments. None of which, I mean, you can't dispute that this is what the deterrent was, right? It was not an attack on bases, it was an attack on civilian populations, or a threatened attack. Now, yes, maybe, if you weren't faced with an enemy that didn't care about following the natural law as you do, that would make sense. But what do you do when you are faced with an enemy that is not about to listen to these arguments? Domestically, what do you do about people who are not going to obey the law? Right? There's only so much punishment you can mete out. And my own essay and several others draw out, there seems to have been for Strauss a hierarchy of the wisdom of natural law. He's critical of Aquinas, but on the other hand seems to accept that Aquinas, the Thomistic tradition, was keeping alive an older Platonic Aristotelian understanding of politics, that he of natural right, in singular, not rights, that Strauss was trying to revive. As you get into the modern period with Suarez, Cajetan, Bellarmine, as you get into the 20th century with Maritain, you seem to you lose that. And it's almost an acceptance of modern political thought. And that's where he thinks that certainly the natural law took a wrong turn. And I would just say that there's a marvelous passage in Aquinas, where he is himself quoting Augustine, on whether or not brothels should be, all the brothels should be closed. And he quotes Proverbs, the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood. That sometimes trying to solve the problem makes things worse. So, quoting Augustine, know lest the world be consumed in lust, right? That you can't do everything you would like to do. You can't make the world perfect. Which I think in the wisest elements, you can see this. In Centesimus Annus, John Paul II mentions the fact that the Catholic Church is accepting of imperfect political orders. It doesn't require a perfect political order. And that's where I think there are elements of prudence within the natural law tradition, but sometimes it gets pushed, and this is the point of my essay, into an absolute rigidity that is not, that, you know, you can't force upon the crooked timber of humanity.
And this is where Strauss, where some conservatives would find a strong allegiance to Strauss.
Yes.
Just that skepticism of perfectibility. Not denial.
No.
But simply a more cautious approach, lest we sink into some utopian dreams about what should be done. Right. And I imagine that is what, you know, I remember with the rise of the neoconservatives, mm-hmm, during W's first term.
Yes.
And especially their influence on some of the foreign policy. But I think I remember a New York Times story putting Strauss among with perhaps Lionel Trilling as the grandfathers,
yes,
of neoconservatism. And everyone was trying to decide, what is neoconservatism? Trying to do a genealogy of it. But I imagine Strauss would have been uneasy with some of the internationalist designs of the neoconservatives of those ages, or not?
I think he would have been. Now, he greatly appreciated the statesmanship of Winston Churchill. There's several instances in which he praises Churchill as a great statesman. Now, what does that mean for 21st century Middle East adventurism?
Yeah.
I can't quite say. But, of course, the term neoconservatism, it started in the 70s, maybe late 60s, where it's simply domestic policy, right? The neoconservatives were ones who looked at social science findings and said, oh gosh, all of these social programs
that we great thought society would, programs.
We thought they'd fix things, they're making things worse. It's only in the late 90s that you get this turn that they had no interest, as far as I can tell, in international relations. Only in the late 90s do you get this term that neoconservatism means something different. Mm-hmm. It means a sort of universalism of human values, or that like Bush's idea that all people are yearning to be free, and to be liberal Democrats, which I think that notion Strauss would certainly disagree with, that every society is a liberal democracy waiting to come out. I think that's not something he could ever agree with.
Let me close with one question. Strauss is often popularly known as someone who believes that philosophical texts have esoteric meanings, that they have the double meaning, the little lower layer that philosophers kind of communicate with one another in that way. Would he approach the Bible in the same way?
Well, this is a curious thing, and Philippe Benetton, in his essay,
his essay, what prompted my question?
Yes,
in the volume, yes.
The comparison of Strauss and Pascal.
Yes.
Yes. So Strauss's insight that he has at a certain point in the 30s is that philosophers were not writing as if they lived in liberal democracies. They had to hide some of their ideas. And this is there are several reasons. There's a wonderful book by Arthur Meltzer called Philosophy Between the Lines, which does a beautiful job of I think, capturing every single instance of somebody explaining this idea in the history of Western literature. But there are several ideas. One, you write esoterically, because if you flat out say what you believe, you'll get a knock on the door and you'll be dragged away. Mm-hmm. But there are other reasons for esoteric writing. One is for the purpose of educating your reader. You don't tell them the punchline. You don't give them the answer. They have to work it out for themselves. Mm-hmm. So there are various reasons for esoteric writing. And this is Strauss's big idea.
Would that apply to works such as the Gospels? I mean, I guess that would mean, do you read the Gospels as, you can read them as a philosopher would read them. Are the writers, I mean, you mentioned the Gospel of John. Do we need to read that esoterically?
The curious thing is that he seems not to have read Scripture esoterically. But as Benetton points out, Christians do. If you read any Christian reading the Hebrew prophets, is not reading it as a literal account of the Davidic kingdom. It's a prefigurement of Christ's kingdom, which you can only understand if you read between the lines. Oh, I notice this. The three messengers who appear to Abraham and announce that Sarah will conceive. Christians look at them as an indication of the Trinity. If you're reading it literally, that you can't do that. They're just three messengers, three guys who show up. Maybe they're angels, but there's no Trinitarian
And it's not just that that esoteric meaning is just sort of a metaphorical, but the esoteric meaning has to be more systematic than that.
Yes.
Right? It can't just be one occasion of reading between the lines or reading it ironically. There has to be a more consistent understanding running through the texts in some, at least as some kind of motif.
Yes, you can't just pick it up once or twice. Now, I often try to explain to students, anyone who has children will do this. You will speak to your spouse and say something that you hope the kids don't understand, but the two of you do know, you know what's going on, but and you'll talk about it later.
Right.
And you have there is a certain systematic way of doing that within a family. Now, for a writer like Plato, it's much more systematic. How else do you explain these dialogues, which on the face of them don't really tell you much? Right? What would you do? You read Plato, and at the end of it, you don't have a system. And so that either means he's not worth reading, which perhaps your experience with some of the professors in the philosophy department you mentioned earlier, perhaps that's how they read Plato. It's a bunch of ridiculous claims that are unsupported and you don't get anywhere. Or you read, like, says, no, he's pointing to something that needs to be untangled in the same way that Christians, not Strauss, but Christians would read the Hebrew scriptures, certainly as this needs to be untangled and look how it prefigures Christ. And yes, I think there are elements of the Gospels where that's also true. St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, you're spiritual children, and so I give you milk, not meat. He seems to, there's a distinction for Paul there, right? There is milk, and then there's meat. There's something you're ready for, and that which will have to come later. Aquinas also mentions this in a commentary on Boethius, that there are things for the wise and things for the unwise, and you have to couch those statements for the wise in obscure language. So I think there's a tradition within the Christian church, certainly the Catholic church, of understanding this distinction between two levels of understanding, maybe even more levels.
Very good. The book is Leo Strauss and His Catholic Readers, which you can find at Catholic University Press's website. Thank you, Professor Vaughn.
Thank you very much.